Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. March 8, 2021. Thrive Global published my new article, Women Can Repair the World. If women express a desire for humanity's unity above all of its divisions and if they unite as a major force with this desire, they will urge men in the direction of unity. Whether our global home stands or falls apart in complete destruction depends on women. The celebrations of the International Women's Day this year should be a reminder of the fact that the female force is a unifying power and is the kind of leadership so needed in these critical times as the world slowly tries to get back on its feet from a long bout of COVID-19. Women have been at the epicenter of the pandemic, in the front lines of healthcare services and particularly hit hard by job losses. But this could be used as an opportunity for a new start to shape a more balanced society. When men receive such a strong impetus to unite from women, they will work to fulfill those demands and will strive to unite and balance with the unified form of nature that functions with altruistic connections between all of its parts. Therefore, women's strengths should be directed to female unity so they could contribute to society's prosperity and happiness through unifying their efforts into building a new, comfortable and welcoming home for human society. Studies on the socio-economic impact of the pandemic show that women have been nearly twice as likely as men to lose their jobs as a result of the COVID-19 outbreak. As a palliative solution, the UN recommends a temporary basic income for 6 months. The amount would vary depending on each country's standard of living. We have reached a critical point where these measures should already be implemented and considered for a longer period of time. On one hand, help should be provided to both men and women in a way that allows them to live with dignity, without excess but covering their basic needs. On the other hand, we need to make sure that every woman also has the opportunity to continue her work from home. If we thus use the time when we are bound to our homes in order to upgrade our awareness of nature's unifying principle and to implement it in our relationships, we will then see far-reaching positive impacts of the COVID-19 crisis, a shift into a completely new and harmonious state among humanity, the likes of which we have never experienced before. Through the pandemic, nature is trying to wake us to our need to make a further step in our evolution. To exercise positive, supportive, encouraging and considerate relations. Our selfish makeup is what led us to create a society that functions with each one trying to profit off everyone else. Operating this way throws us all off balance. Essentially, we now need to reach a state where we care about others to the same extent we care about ourselves. If we know the right place for men, women, parents, and children as components in society that complement each other, we will progress nicely in support and in mutual strengthening. According to nature's structure, the female represents the desire to receive while the male represents the intention to give. Therefore, if women express a desire for humanity's unity above all of its divisions and if they unite as a major force with this desire, they will urge men in the direction of unity. Then, when men receive such a strong impetus to unite from women, they will work to fulfill those demands and will strive to unite and balance with the unified form of nature that functions with altruistic connections between all of its parts. Therefore, women's strengths should be directed to female unity so they could contribute to society's prosperity and happiness through unifying their efforts into building a new, comfortable and welcoming home for human society. We will all feel as if we share a common home, like we live among a giant loving family in a completely new and upgraded kind of awareness of the laws of nature and the world we exist in. Now is the time to repair the world as only women know how to do. I wish you success. Published on March 8, 2021. My new article on LinkedIn: What to Do with Vocal, Anti-Semitic Academics. Professor of Political Sociology David Miller of the University of Bristol recently referred to Jewish students on his campus as pawns of Israel, a violent, racist, foreign regime engaged in ethnic cleansing. Such accusations are baseless and absurd. However, the more interesting point about this statement is that while more than 100 MPs, members of parliament, and peers from every big political party called on the University of Bristol to act against Professor Miller, some 200 academics from the United Kingdom and the United States signed a petition defending him. This petition demonstrates that Miller's views are not only his own, that many people share them, even if some of them hide their antisemitism behind the free speech cloak. The more we stall with implementing our ancient union and our ancient task, the more the world will hate us. The more international relations deteriorate the world over, the more the world will blame it on the Jews, and particularly on Israel. We should not take this lightly. It is our chance to carry out our mission, and we must not miss out on the opportunity. If we shun this invitation to be a light unto nations, the world will not forgive us, and we will have no one else to blame but ourselves. Because Miller's views are so pervasive, I think it is time for us to realize that silencing anti-Semites will not stop anti-Semitism. Instead, we must use such incidents as levers to explain our place in the world as a nation and as a state. First, we must agree that no matter how badly we want to be like everyone else, Jews are not like other nations. If the whole world singles you out for condemnation, simply telling the world that it is wrong will not convince anyone. Even if the facts are in your favor, hate-filled people do not listen to facts. Their feelings are the only justification they need. Therefore, if the world hates us, and it does, we should try to understand why. Take any nation, besides Jews, and you will find a common origin. Every nation started with a nucleus that had some biological affinity. The Jewish people, from the very beginning, were different. We began when people from different places, different faiths, and no biological affinity whatsoever, found a common tenet that they shared and wanted to implement in practice. That tenet was union above division, affinity over enmity, or as King Solomon put it, love will cover all crimes, Prof. 10:12. Rabbi Akiva stated it even more explicitly when he said that the tenet love your neighbor as yourself is the great rule of Jewish law, the Torah. Through their efforts to practice this hitherto unthinkable idea, our ancestors created such a tight bond among them that they united as one man with one heart and formed a new nation out of countless prior enemies. In a sense, the ancient Israelites implemented among themselves the idea of world peace before anyone had thought of the idea. Indeed, right from the very beginning, it became clear that the unique union the early Jews had established should serve as a role model for the rest of the world, that this is how nations should live with one another. But no one, besides the Jews, had ever done it, or tried it, or even thought of the idea. Clearly, it was up to the Jews to spread the idea and the method for implementing brotherhood above differences and hatred. This is why the Torah writes that the Jews were intended to be a light unto nations, that their task was to show the way for achieving peace and harmony throughout the world, as they had achieved among themselves. Acclaimed historian Paul Johnson eloquently captured the essence and vocation of the Jewish people in his book A History of the Jews. At a very early stage in their collective existence, they, Jews, believed they had detected a divine scheme for the human race, of which their own society was to be a pilot. While we were in exile, we were dispersed among the nations and could not be that pilot society. But now that we have returned to our land, the ancient duty has become valid, and accordingly, the demand of the nations that we implement it has grown more pressing. The state of Israel, the state of the Jewish people, is therefore the place where Jews should unite above their differences and cover all the crimes of mutual hatred with love. If we do this, the world will justify our existence as a sovereign state. If we do not, they will use every pretext to deny our legitimacy until they finally resolve to terminate the existence of the Jewish state. The more we stall with implementing our ancient union and our ancient task, the more the world will hate us. The more international relations deteriorate the world over, the more the world will blame it on the Jews, and particularly on Israel. We should not take this lightly. It is our chance to carry out our mission, and we must not miss out on the opportunity. If we shun this invitation to be a light unto nations, the world will not forgive us, and we will have no one else to blame but ourselves. My new article on LinkedIn equality ad absurdum. Recently, six of the popular children's books author Dr. Seuss were banned from Amazon for ostensibly containing racist content. As a child, Dr. Seuss, who came from German descent, was himself a victim of prejudice after suffering from anti-German aggression following the outbreak of World War I in 1914. Ironically, now his own books have been banned for ostensibly containing racist phrases. This accusation is so absurd that people responded with buying so many of Dr. Seuss books that they have soared to the top of Amazon's bestseller list, occupying 9 out of the marketplace's top 10 books. Only if we try to build closeness, care, and appreciation of each other will we put an end to bigotry in our society and form truly healthy and enjoyable communities to live in. The absurdity of the quest for equality doesn't stop with Dr. Seuss. In many high-tech companies, as well as in other areas, it has become a requirement that a certain percentage of executives will be women, regardless of their skills. In some cases, women must attend meetings even if they're not in their areas of expertise, take part in decision-making processes, and even cast their vote despite everyone's awareness that they are completely clueless on the topic. But if no women are included in the vote, the decision will be invalid. Another place where the pursuit of equality has gone beyond the boundaries of reason is computers. Terms such as blacklist and whitelist have been replaced in many cases with denialist and allowlist, and the terms master and slave in computer networks have been replaced with primary and secondary. Indeed, the quest for equality has reached absurd proportions. We can't help it, people always have been, are, and will be different. This is what they should be. Differences do not make people better or worse, superior or inferior, but striving to make them the same does make them miserable. People are not born equal because we are all unique. Erasing our uniqueness is exactly what harms us. Instead of trying to cut everyone according to the measurements of the moral Procrustean bed, so everyone is seemingly the same and equally unhappy, we should embrace our differences because what one person contributes to society, no other person can contribute. We shouldn't be working on installing equal status for everyone in society, but on cultivating equal appreciation and care for all members of society, on appreciating everyone's unique contribution. If we value one another, we won't need to worry about discrimination or inequity, since our concern for one another will generate positive relationships among everyone. Think of a mother with 2 children. She does not think that both her children are the same or equal, but that doesn't mean she doesn't love them equally. If one of them is a slower learner than the other, she might hire a tutor to help the struggling child. This doesn't mean that she discriminates one of her children. She is simply tending to her children's different needs equally. Since one child needs more help than the other, the mother responds accordingly. Therefore, if we want to live in a society where people are happy, we needn't try to make them equal, but to make them caring. Mutual care is the only guarantee we can provide to the well-being of society and the people living in it. Fighting against racism, anti-Semitism, chauvinism, or any kind of discrimination has never solved any of them. Only if we try to build closeness, care, and appreciation of each other will we put an end to bigotry in our society and form truly healthy and enjoyable communities to live in. My new article on LinkedIn: Understanding Negative Social Phenomena. In recent years, it seems as though one of the hottest topics in public discourse has been racism. But not only racism has been a hot topic, any kind of discrimination has become a topic of great public interest. Racism, Whether against blacks or against Jews, misogyny, homophobia, xenophobia, and even discrimination based on political views, have all gained notoriety. All men and women are not born equal. We are born different, and our diversity drives our development as a human race. Just as no two animals, plants, or even rocks are the same, and the diversity of nature drives evolution, so it is with human diversity. The difference between human society and the rest of nature is that people, unlike any other element in creation, strive for absolute dominance. Deep down, each of us, consciously or not, strives for superiority. This is why we do not accept differences among people. We want everyone to be the same, equal. Whenever such a topic receives attention, politicians, journalists, and celebrities jump on the bandwagon and blare their views emphatically. These statements may help their careers, but I have yet to see one problem solved by sanctimonious assertions and contempt for other people's views. If we want to solve social problems, we must understand where they come from and uproot them at the core. All men and women are not born equal. We are born different, and our diversity drives our development as a human race. Just as no two animals, plants, or even rocks are the same, and the diversity of nature drives evolution, so it is with human diversity. The difference between human society and the rest of nature is that people, unlike any other element in creation, strive for absolute dominance. Deep down, each of us, consciously or not, strives for superiority. This is why we do not accept differences among people. We want everyone to be the same, equal. However, we will only think that people should be the same if they are the same as me. Anyone who does not think like me is wrong, should be re-educated, or eliminated. Of course, this is an extreme presentation of human ambitions and most people do not maintain such extremist views, but it is nonetheless the driving force behind social mindsets. As just stated, diversity is essential, it drives our development. The problem is our attitude toward it. To change our attitude toward diversity and make it constructive, we need to understand that were it not for diversity, we wouldn't be here, we'd be extinct. Diversity means mutual complementation, where each element provides what no other element can. Just as we wouldn't want salmon to be sharks, and just as we wouldn't want our hearts to become kidneys, so we shouldn't want anyone to be anything other than what they are. We may not see the contribution of each person to society, but ignorance does not excuse mistakes. As Martin Luther King, Jr. already pointed out, nothing in all the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. Therefore, to solve negative social phenomena, we should relate to them constructively. Every time a problem manifests, we should treat it as an invitation for correction. It is not the problem itself that we should fix, but the hatred that has caused it. As said above, people's differences make them hate one another, which manifests in different ways each time. Nevertheless, it is always the hatred that we must correct, and not the differences. Think of the most extreme examples, such as hatred between whites and blacks in America. We shouldn't expect blacks to become, or even want to become white, or the other way around. We should, however, work on recognizing the contribution of each past to society, on the unique values and beauty that each race and color possesses, and then we will come to love one another precisely because of who we are, and we will not want each other to change. The idea is therefore not to change one another, but build love atop the differences, and in fact, precisely because of them. If we were able to see the beauty and unique contribution of each element in society, we would grasp how dependent we are on the success and prosperity of each person in society. We wouldn't need to deal with social problems since they would dissolve in the love that would surround everyone. If a certain problem did appear, we would treat it as a sign that we have not completed our work and there is more love to build, this time around a new rift that we did not see before. If we treat our differences in this constructive manner, we will be thankful every day that we have so many people of so many colors, creeds, and races. My new article on LinkedIn: a two-pronged solution to campus antisemitism. Academia has become a bastion of antisemitism across the globe, and both the UK and the US are not exceptions. The most recent case of inflammatory statements against Jews and Israel emerged from David Miller, a professor of political sociology at the University of Bristol who advocates to end Zionism, and who accused Jewish students of being used as political pawns by a violent, racist foreign regime engaged in ethnic cleansing. The hatred against Jews will not be ended by saying he is not right. As Jews, we can only stop the problem of antisemitism through a two-pronged approach, explain the root of it, and fulfill our expected role by establishing unity among us. As it is written in the Book of Zohar, everything stands on love, va'etchanan. It is the obligation of the Jewish people to unite in order to show the way for the cohesion and balance of the entire human race by implementing the great tenet of the Torah, love your neighbor as yourself. When this happens, animosity towards Jews and Israel will transform into praise and appreciation. Miller's words left no one indifferent. A good number of scholars signed a letter backing Miller's right to academic freedom, while hundreds of professors from around the world, in contrast, penned another letter criticizing his hateful idiocy. Bristol University, in the meantime, has not removed him from his position and merely expressed that they do not endorse his statements. As uncomfortable as it might be, antisemitism is a natural manifestation in people. We can punish haters on college campuses or in any other educational institutions, and it will never end the problem. In the place of this antisemitic professor, there will be another 100, and another 200. And thousands upon thousands that will continue multiplying worldwide. We already see this undeniable phenomenon in America, where forces against Jewish students are not only growing but strengthening over time. The high value Jewish tradition has placed on education attracts many young Jews to college and university campuses, and their prominent participation puts them at the crosshairs of anti-Jewish and anti-Zionist sentiments. We need to understand that what lies behind antisemitism is rooted in history, all the way back to ancient Babylon, where the Jewish people emerged some 4,000 years ago. The people of Babylon thrived at first and worked in unity toward common goals, but later, as their intensifying egos alienated them from one another, they fell into unfounded hatred. The solution proposed by Nimrod, king of Babylon, was the dispersion of the people. He argued that when people are far from one another, they do not quarrel. Abraham, at the time a renowned Babylonian sage, suggested a second solution. He had observed the integrality of nature and pointed out that it is nature's dictate that human society must eventually become united. Therefore, he campaigned to unite the Babylonians despite and atop their growing egos. Today humanity finds itself in a state very similar to the one the ancient Babylon experienced. We are globally interdependent, yet, at the same time, we are alienated from one another. But because we have already spread throughout the world, Nimrod's solution of parting ways is no longer practical. We are now required to use Abraham's method. Because we as Jewish people have previously implemented Abraham's method and achieved a state of optimal connection, we must rekindle our unity and teach the method of connection to the whole of humanity. If we fail to do so, the pressure against the Jewish people will continue to escalate. Antisemitism can only be solved through two thrusts: 1, advocacy against antisemitism on the one hand, and 2, the proper functioning of the role of Israel to exemplify and educate for unity, on the other. This must take place both in theory and in practice. In other words, we need to explain that when the Jewish nation fell from its moral apex of love of others, hatred of Israel among the nations began. Through antisemitism, the nations prod us to disclose the method of connection. Therefore, the people of Israel, descendants of the ancient Babylonians who followed Abraham, are required to set an example for the whole of humanity and thus become a light unto nations. As it is written in the book of Zohar, everything stands on love, Vayetchanan. It is the obligation of the Jewish people to unite in order to show the way for the cohesion and balance of the entire human race by implementing the great tenet of the Torah, love your neighbor as yourself. When this happens, animosity towards Jews and Israel will transform into praise and appreciation. The Creator is playing hide and seek with us. My sons defeated me. That is, not one person but precisely together. Anyone who wants to reveal the Creator must unite with others like himself. And only when they feel themselves as one, as the sons of the Creator, can they come to him, demand and overpower his concealment. The Creator is hiding on purpose so that we can search for him. He will not quarrel forever because he wants to reveal himself, but only if we search for him and need to reveal him. Therefore, the more of us who seek him, the greater the revelation of the Creator, exactly as it is said, my sons defeated me, that is, many sons. The Creator is waiting for our quest and rejoices when we defeat him. After all the concealment created by him is designed to make us grow, to awaken us, to seek and reveal the Creator. The Creator is always revealed from concealment, and we must make an effort to unite. To the extent that we unite and eliminate all the forces of separation that operate between us, we will turn them from forces of separation into forces of revelation, and to the extent of our efforts, we will reveal the Creator in them. My sons defeated me means that we are turning concealment into revelation. Of course, we cannot do it ourselves, but we demand the Creator to help us. Therefore, our work consists of two parts. First, to unite by reaching one desire, one aspiration, and second, to seek the Creator and oblige him to reveal himself. We are always working mutually, I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. And when we almost succeed in defeating the concealment, the Creator immediately hides and forces us to search for him again. And so again and again, because only from both forms, concealment and revelation, do we clarify all the qualities of the Creator and turn them into our own qualities. The revelation of the Creator can only be in the equivalence of form, in the reflection of his qualities in our qualities. Therefore, spiritual advancement always goes through concealment and revelation. And if we do not associate our states with either revelation or concealment, then we do not relate to spirituality at all and are not directed toward the Creator. After all, the path to the Creator can have only two alternatives, either concealment or revelation. A person who seeks the revelation of the upper world must direct himself correctly, always discovering the concealment and revelation over all his qualities and actions. And the greater the concealment, the greater revelation comes after it, one against the other. In order to reveal the Creator, it is necessary to organize a group because the Creator only reveals himself as 10 Sephirot. And so, we need to discover the 10 desires that are properly connected and united by a common intention, to feel ready to unite and support each other like the 10 Sephirot of the spiritual part Suf. All are included in all and become ready for the revelation of one force. And although all tens are very different and separated by their egoism, since we come out of one force, then by annulling our egoism, we again become as if one whole and have the opportunity to reveal new forms of the Creator, one, one and only. The Creator is playing hide and seek with us, he hides, we search and find him, and he hides again. So we run after him and in this pursuit gradually study him and format our desires in equivalence with the upper force, preparing them for the revelation of all the qualities of the upper light. What is learned in the ten is already a spiritual gain that remains in the Kelim forever. But one person is not able to keep spiritual thoughts and feelings within himself. From the World Kabbalah Convention 2021, Discovering Life in the Ten, the 28th of February 2021, The Ten, a Musical Instrument in the Creator's Hands, Lesson 9. Resettlement of the Babylonians. Comment: there are some similarities between the way Abraham and his 1,000 followers left Babylon and the way the Israelites left Egypt. The difference is that Abraham was not pursued and the Israelites were pursued by Pharaoh and his army. My response: Abraham divided the people in a very simple way. He left most of the Babylonians, knowing that they with their egoism would scatter from each other anyway. This is described in the great commentary, Midrash Rabbah, which refers to the same time as the book of creation of Abraham. Thus, we have sources written 4,500 years ago. Of course, this is not recent history, but in principle, we can believe it because as we reveal these ancient stories, we see more and more that what is written in those books is really true. Although Babylon was originally inhabited by a single nation of about 3,000 people, they were still a collection of many ancient tribes, clans. Abraham was also from a tribe called Ivory. That's why he was called Abraham the Ivory. The famous historian Josephus Flavius, whom we can trust, describes very clearly how people settled all over the earth. One part of the Babylonians went to Germany, another to the Apennines, a third to the east, to India and China, a fourth to the north, toward Russia, a fifth to Africa, and so on. Although he calls this by other names, but, in principle, you can guess. From Cab TV's The Power of the Book of Zohar number 6. Gifts from Abraham. Abraham was a very famous, respected person in ancient Babylon. Therefore, his Kabbalistic teachings successfully spread among the Babylonians. It is said that he presented them with the whole idea of future spiritual development. Rambam, the great philosopher of the 12th century, wrote that thousands of people followed Abraham. Thousands. He led them away from Babylon into the land of Israel. Those who did not follow him, because they did not feel an inner predisposition to become similar to the Creator, decided to scatter around the globe. The original sources say that Abraham gave them so-called gifts. The gifts mean that he has taught them all sorts of other methods that are based not on overcoming egoism and not on correcting it in the middle line in order to advance above the ego and rise from Huggut to Habud. On the contrary, these methods are based on reducing egoism, belittling it, and being satisfied with modest and small things. In other words, Abraham gave the Babylonians the beginnings of beliefs and religions. This is how they settled all over the earth. We see that those spiritual teachings, especially the Eastern ones, as well as religions, are built on being modest, not standing out among others. They do not encourage the development of egoism and even the development of machinery and technology. These theories are completely opposite to the method of Kabbalah, which says, the more egoism, the better because with its help we can rise and correct ourselves. However, if a person has no desire for correction, then it is better for him to belittle his egoism and keep his head down. From Cab TV's The Power of the Book of Zohar number 6. Remember the Sabbath day to sanctify it. Question: the fourth commandment is, remember the Sabbath day to sanctify it. Why is it necessary for man to observe a certain day, to rest on this day, and is it so important to the Creator? Answer: it is important because there is a cycle. Every seventh day is a break, as if stopping the entire universe and starting it again. This is called a week. Comment: you said that the work of man takes place during 6 days that symbolize the six sephirot of Zeir and Pin. Let's say our entire work is to connect with others. For 6 days man seems to work on his own. But he must understand that even if he works on the seventh day, it will not bring him any benefit. The Creator must complete the work for him. My response: this is not about our everyday work. It is written that the Creator worked for 6 days and rested on the seventh day. This means that we are supposed to work for 6 days and rest on the seventh day. But this does not mean working as the Creator. His work is creation. It is Hesed, Gvura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, six directions. And our work is to kind of modify ourselves in accordance to these six categories. When we finish it, we come to the last one. But the last category is realized in us, by itself. Therefore, there is nothing to do here, just not to interfere. If you have correctly attracted the six forces upon yourself, then the seventh force, Shabbat, from the word Shvita, a break during work, does all the work itself precisely because you do not interfere with the actions of the Creator. You have received from the Creator everything possible in the six stages, the so-called 6 days, which are united in you, and then on the seventh day, you receive their result. Question: so, are we talking about internal spiritual work? When I pass these 6 degrees, the next one starts automatically. Does it mean that even if I wanted to, I could not work? Answer: no, absolutely not. This is the work of the light. The seventh degree is the sum, the result of the previous 6 degrees. We only need to allow it to be realized. Question: it means that if a person has connected with another by his own efforts, then pride arises in him. This is not the connection we are talking about. Do we need to make an effort and then leave the work to the Creator? Answer: always. Because you will not be able to finish it by yourself anyway. From Cab TV's Spiritual States, December 26, 2019.